problem.
So two remarks about measured wall structure. The first is that if you take x mu and x mu measured wall structures on the same set x, then if you take the measure mu plus mu, this is still a measured wall structure. And moreover, the wall metric associated to mu plus mu is the sum of d mu and d mu. And that's the first remark. The other remark is a word about functoriality, that suppose that Y nu is a measured wall structure, and you have a map from a set X to the set Y, then you may pull back the measured wall structure on nu onto X. Okay, I'm using this notation F upper star because it's a pullback, but how do we define this measure? Well, the fact is that you have a well-defined map at the level of sets, of subsets, which is the map F inverse, going from subsets of Y to subsets of X. And remember that nu is a measure which lives here. So you can push it forward. You can push it forward using F inverse, and this is how I define F upper star nu. Okay. And remember from this morning that we saw what it means for a group to act properly on the measured wall structure. So, here's the theorem. Due to Chatterjee, Guttu, and Haglund in 2008, with previous results for discrete groups. So G is locally compact, sigma compact, and what the theorem says is that three properties are equivalent. Namely, the first is that G has the Haglund property, or is AP nominal. Second, G acts properly on some measured wall structure. And third, there exists a measured wall structure on G itself, for which, I mean, which is G invariant and proper. So, and with respect to the left multiplication of G on itself. So, what is interesting is the equivalence between 1 and 2. And let me discuss briefly the easy parts of that result. So, proof of easy parts. I think that there is one obvious implication, which is 3 implies 2, right? This one is trivial. And the converse, 2 implies 3, is not difficult. Using the second remark I made before, namely that if you have a proper action on some measured wall structure, you use an orbit map, and you pull back the measured wall structure on the group itself. So. Use orbit map to pull back measured wall structure on G. Okay, and maybe more interesting, let me prove that 2 implies 1. Because in this way, we will really see how to construct affine isometric actions. And by the way, all this business around measured wall structure is very much related to what Asaf explained about L1 distance in his talk. And we will see this appearing in the proof. This is something on which I have no time to elaborate, but this is very well explained in the paper by Chatterjee, Brutto and Haglund, which is due to appear in Advances. So 2 implies 1. Well, so suppose that G acts properly on X mu. If you pick up a point X in capital X, let me define a characteristic function, chi sub X, that is the characteristic function of the set of subsets of X through X. So all subsets containing the given X. And then if you take 2 points X and Y, you define C of XY as chi of X minus chi sub X minus chi sub Y. The point is that, so remember that mu is a measure on the power set minus the empty set and the whole set. And the point, chi sub x is certainly not in general not an L2 function, or L1, or well, an LP function, but because by the assumption that we have a measured wall structure, this function C of xy actually lies in any LP space with respect to mu. In particular, it lies in L2. So, because you see, when you integrate it against the measure mu, it gives you exactly the measure of the set separating x from y. So, C of xy is an element of the Hilbert space L2 of 2 to the x minus 5x with respect to the measure mu. And when we compute the L2 norm of it, this is exactly the distance d mu between x and y. And there is also something which is obvious but useful, namely that there is, just by definition, there is this co-cycle relation which is satisfied. And finally, if pi denotes the natural representation of G, so remember that G is acting on the situation, so, and leaving the measure mu invariant, so there is a unitary representation of G on that Hilbert space. And that co-cycle C of xy is completely canonical, therefore it's equivalent. So pi of G Cxy is C of Gx Gy. Okay? Now, fix a base point x naught in capital X. Set B of G, this is C of G x naught, so that's a definition. And the point is that using the cosine condition and the equivalence condition, we see that BG is a one cosine. So B is a one cosine with respect to representation pi. So this means that it satisfies one cosine relation, B of GH is pi of G BH plus BG. And having a one cosine is exactly what you need to turn a unitary representation into an affine representation. So I mean by that, that if you define alpha G V, where V is a vector in the Hilbert space, if you define alpha gv as pi of gv plus b of g, this is an affine isometric representation. Affine isometric representation or action, I should say action. Action of G on H, so that the one cosine property corresponds exactly to the multiplicativity of that map alpha. Alpha of GH is alpha G, alpha H. So we have an action, and the point is that this action is proper because alpha G, if we apply alpha g to the zero vector in the Hilbert space, then take the norm squared, well, this amounts to taking norm squared of b of g. This amounts to taking norm squared of c of g x naught. And by the computation we did previously, this is the distance d mu between g x naught and x naught. And that distance goes to infinity for g going to infinity. in the group. So this means that alpha is metrically proper. I.e. G is 18 model. Okay. All right. So that's the easy part, but with the example, combining this with the examples that I gave in the morning, this gives us a lot of genuine examples of 18 monodal groups. So examples of 18 monodal groups. So I discussed three examples this morning. The first one was trees. So we see that every group acting properly on a tree is 18 monodal. And this gives us, just to name a few, three groups. SL2Z, SL2 of the p-adics, etc. From example 2 was cubical cat zero complexes. So we see that every group acting properly on the cat zero cube complex is 18 monodal. And this gives lots of groups, and one interesting example is for instance is Thomson's group F. So that's so here we reprove the result proved by Dan Fairley a while ago. And from example three was the examples of real hyperbolic spaces, and we see that every closed subgroup of the V group O and 1 is 18 monodal. So here we have some interesting examples like fundamental groups of hyperbolic manifolds. Surface groups are there. Okay. So this shows that this class of 18 monodal groups is rather huge. And as always in group theory, when you single out a class of groups and declare it is interesting, you want to study permanence properties or stability properties. So, under which which operations of the class of groups is the class stable? So let me discuss that. I think that's number 4. Permanence properties. Well, the class of 18 monodal groups is stable under, well, yeah, so first some easy facts. Closed subgroups, basically obvious. Direct products. Free products. Amalgamated products over finite groups, more generally. What else? Yeah. So if H is closed in G, H is a T-mongol, and if you look at the homogeneous space G mod H, so with the action of G, if the action of G is amenable in the sense of MR, and that was precisely the sense discussed in Soyoung's Moon, Soyoung Moon's talk yesterday. So, in the sense of MR means existence of an invariant me over G mod H. All right, so if under this assumption you may lift the Hagrow property from H to G. So then G is A-T-mongol. Okay. All right, so these are a number of positive results. And then comes the main defect, so to speak, of the Hagrow property, which is that A-T-mongolity is not preserved by semi-direct products. And actually, the counterexample, well, the standard counterexample was already mentioned. You take SL2Z and Z squared, they are A-T-mongolable. But, as I mentioned this morning, if you form the semi-direct product, SL2Z semi-direct with Z square, it has relative T with respect to Z square. And therefore, it cannot be a T-mongol. And okay, so this is. So this leads to an open question. If you have H, a group H acting on a group N by automorphism, by group automorphism, under which condition is the semi-direct product H semi-direct with N, where N will sit as a normal subgroup? And under which condition is it A-T-mongol? Okay. Necessary conditions are that H and N them are themselves equiminable because they sit there as subgroups. But then there should be some conditions on the action, and this part is complete. Well, is widely open. However, we have some partial results, and this is what I would like to discuss now. So it's about so-called permutational wreath products. So which are special kites, special sorts of semidirect products, and let me recall what this means. So let H, G, be non-trivial groups. And lambda, a homogeneous space of G. And definition. The permutational wreath product H wreath with G over lambda is, well, first you take a direct sum of copies of H and you index these copies by lambda. And because lambda is about, it carries an action of G, G is acting on the index set. And since it's acting on the index set, it's acting by automorphism on this direct sum. And then you may form the semidirect product. In this generality, the question of the Hagrow property is still open. So we do not know whether, under which condition on lambda, which are the conditions on lambda needed to ensure that, well, the best result would be conditions on lambda which would be equivalent to the Hagrow property for this Wreath product, and so I will discuss the case for which we have a complete answer, and this is the case where lambda is much more than homogeneous space. It's the case where lambda is a portion group of G. So, assume that lambda is a quotient group. That's a strong assumption, the quotient group of G. So, pure. Consider the following two conditions. First, H, G, and lambda are equinormal. Second, the permutation of this product is equinormal. One implies two. Well, okay. I'm trying to have some suspense here, but I think a couple of you know the story. So with Yves Cordelier and Yves Stalder, we proved that 1 implies 2 2 years ago. And we made a daring conjecture that this should be true without the assumption that lambda is equivalent. And this conjecture, which I'm not going to write, was shown to be false in the strongest possible sense the year after by Kifan and Ioana, because what Kifan and Ioana proved is that the converse actually holds. The outcome is that these two conditions are really equivalent. So the 2 implies 1 is due to Kifan and Ioana. I think that concerning Higgs products, that's more or less the best result that we have so far. And I will devote the rest of my time to giving some ideas of the proof. I must say that the proof of the 2 implications are completely different. The proof of the direct implication used measurable structure, and the proof of the converse really uses the definition, it uses representation theory. And maybe I will start with the proof of the Kifan-Ioana result. So 2 implies 1. Where am I? So we assume that the permutation of this product is Hager group. Then, first triviality. So are H and G, because they sit as subgroups. So the non-trivial fact is that lambda is Hager group, because if you remember the definition of a semi-direct product, the lambda is not sitting in the semi-direct product as a subgroup. You see, so remember simply that the action of G is factored through lambda, but lambda itself is not sitting as a subgroup. But however, it's more or less floating around, right? So we should be able to say something. And so that's how they do. So first, they fix a non-trivial element in H. And they look at copies of the cyclic subgroup generated by H, indexed by lambda. So this guy is a subgroup of the Ries product, but the point is that this is an abelian subgroup, right? Not only, well, it's abelian, and also it is G invariant, because G is acting just by shifting indices. So we have that the semi-direct product of A cross G lies into the Ries product, and therefore this semi-direct product is Hager. So that's the first observation. Very simple but crucial. The second observation is that lambda acts on A. Okay. This is a non-standard terminology. Let me say in quotation mark quasi field. This means the following, that if you pick an element in A, which is not the identity of the group, so how can you describe it? Well, it's a function from lambda to that cyclic subgroup, but with finite support. And so this means that if you look at the stabilizer of this element in lambda, this stabilizer is finite. Because lambda is acting by shifting indices. So this support can only be finite, if it is non-trivial. And now, okay, this being said, here is the proposition that Kiffan and Johanna really proved. Kiffan and Johanna. So, we have G, lambda, which is a quotient group. And lambda acts on A, which is abelian. And lambda acts by automorphism. And we make the assumption that there exists some element in A, which is not the identity, such that the stabilizer in lambda of this element is finite. And then if the semi-direct product. And now, okay, now we form the semi-direct product with G, and it is understood that G acts, the action of G factors through lambda, right? But the theorem says that if a semi-direct G is atenable, then so is lambda. And so be. From the remarks I made just before, this exactly does the job to prove the converse of the theorem, which is on the left of the blackboard. And okay, let me sketch the proof of this proposition. So. By contraposition. What do you say in English? Contrapositive, maybe. who's a native speaker? Do you say contraposition or contrapositive in English?
Contrapositive.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Yeah, thanks. by contrapositive. So assume lambda is not cardinal. And so we want to show that the semi-direct product itself is not a group, so let pi be a unitary representation of the semi-direct product, and we assume that it has almost invariant vectors, so it weakly contains a trivial representation of A equals G. And we must show that pi is not C0. Okay. But the point is that now we are in position to use a true weapon, because we have a semidirect product within a billion normal subgroup. And so, use the spectral theorem. So this means that when we restrict the representation to the abelian normal subgroup, it will decompose as a direct integral of characters. So A hat denotes the Pontryagin dual, the space of characters of A, with a certain spectral measure dE chi. And to get numbers rather than operators, I will immediately use the scalar product. So if psi is a vector in the Hilbert space of norm 1, then what this equality here means is that if you take a group element A in the abelian normal subgroup, and from the coefficient meet the coefficient of pi of A psi xi, this is given as the usual integral over A hat of chi of A d mu xi of chi, where mu xi is a probability measure on A hat. And this probability measure satisfies a number of interesting features, namely, if you take two unit vectors, psi and eta, and compare the corresponding probability measures, say that this is the total variation distance. Well, this total variation distance is less than twice the distance between the two vectors in the unit sphere of the Hilbert space. So that's one fact. The second fact is that if we remember that pi is not only a representation of A, but a representation of the semidirect product, so this means that this spectral measure must satisfy some equivalence with respect to the G action. And here it is. Mu of pi of G xi is actually the push forward of mu xi under G, for G in the acting group. And finally, something which is less standard, but not very difficult to prove, which is that okay, I hope it's clear what it means. I take an element G in the acting group, an element A in the normal subgroup, and first I act on A via what? Did I define alpha? I'm afraid not. So alpha is the action. Is the action of lambda. So alpha is the homomorphism from lambda to the automorphism of A, given which gives the action. So here what this means, first I take G, I project it to lambda via the quotient map, and which I didn't define, I'm afraid. So, okay. P is a quotient map to lambda. and I act on an element in the normal circle. And this new to this new element, I apply the representation phi, okay? And then I act on the vector psi in the Hilbert space. And this distance can be squared. And this will be less than pi of a psi, psi minus psi squared plus twice the variation distance between g star mu psi and mu psi. Okay. So. So now we have another assumption on this representation phi, which is that it almost has invariant vectors. So let psi m be a sequence of almost invariant vectors in h pi. Norm 1, psi, norm of psi n is 1, and by combining the first two properties about the spectral measure of psi, we see that the corresponding measures, mu psi n, are asymptotically invariant. So they are more and more invariant under g. For g in the acting. All right. Now, let x be some infinite subset of lambda, so which is to be specified later. And then we have this assumption that there, for some element in the normal subgroup, the stabilizer in lambda is finite. So let me pick such an element. Then using the third inequality on the left of the blackboard, I have that if I apply a group element in lambda to A, then apply the representation phi and apply this to the almost invariant vector psi n, this will be less than pi of a psi n minus psi n squared plus twice the supremum over lambda in x of lambda star of mu psi n minus psi n. So here, I am weakening that part of the inequality by replacing it by the supremum over the whole of f of x. But the idea is as follows. Assume that for some subsequence n sub k, we have that the supremum over lambda in x of lambda star mu psi n sub k minus mu psi n sub k goes to zero. Okay, going to infinity. If this happens, then the corresponding supremum here will also go to zero uniformly. Then we have that the supremum over all gamma in x of pi alpha gamma a psi n sub k minus psi n sub k. This is zero. And the point is that if you look at the set of elements of the form alpha gamma a, a is fixed once and for all, but gamma is moving into some infinite set. So the set of elements in the, of the form alpha gamma a is infinite. Why? Because the stabilizer in lambda is finite. So we have just finitely many identifications here. So this here runs into an infinite subset of A. So we have that this distance goes uniformly to zero on some infinite subset, and this implies that the representation pi is not C zero. Because if you square this, you will see that the scalar product will converge to one uniformly on an infinite subset, which prevents it to be C zero. So, conclusion. Not C0 because pi of alpha gamma a psi n sub k scalar product with psi n sub k goes to 1 uniformly on some infinite subset of k. All right. So, you see, what we have to do now is to find some infinite set, capital X, and some subsequence. And there is an assumption that we haven't used so far, which is the contrapositive assumption that lambda is not Hager root. And if you remember the this lemma by Ackman, Walter, and Peterson from this morning, of course, we at some point we want to use this lemma, but there is one missing ingredient so far, which is that this lemma involves some positive definite functions of over lambda. So this means it involves some representations, and we haven't representations of lambda so far. So. So to find x and n sub k, want to apply Peterson's lemma, and we need some representations of lambda. And okay, so to simplify notation, let me denote by mu sub n what was called before mu sub psi n. And assume there is a probability measure mu n on the dual a hat, which is lambda quasi-invariant and which moreover satisfies that first, it's close to mu n, say that the total variation distance is less than something small, and gamma star mu n minus mu n should go to zero for n going to infinity for every gamma in lambda. So, assume this happens. Assume, I will explain, and that will be the coup de grace, how to find this, this probability measure. But first, assume that this probability measure mu n exists. What can I, well, what good does it do for me? Well, it allows me to construct representations precisely. Then on the Hilbert space L2 of A hat mu n, get a unitary representation sigma n of lambda by the following formula. Okay. So, you see, lambda is acting on a hat. So if I take a function on a hat, I'm tempted to let lambda act on function, just like that. But that representation would not be unitary because the measure mu n is not lambda invariant. But because it is quasi-invariant, I have a trick, a standard trick to modify it, to make it unitary. And this is multiplying by the Radon-Nikodym cocycle. Namely that here I'm writing the Radon-Nikodym derivative at chi, and take the square root of this Radon-Nikodym derivative. And this defines, it's completely standard, it defines a unitary representation. But the point is that remember that mu n is a probability measure. And so there is a distinguished vector in that Hilbert space. That's the constant function 1. So eta n is a constant function 1 in that Hilbert, in that Hilbert space, yes. And then, well, a computation using the fact that un is more—it's not invariant, but it's more and more invariant. And as a consequence, the scalar product of eta. That's supposed to be lambda. So this sequence of coefficients goes to 1 pointwise of lambda. And so here we are in position to apply the lemma by Peterson. Provides an infinite subset X and a subsequence NK. And if you believe what I said above, this would be enough to conclude that the representation pi is not C0. And okay, so what is missing? What is missing is precisely that I claim that this sequence of probability measure exists. So to conclude, let me write them down. So, finally, let us write mu n. And for this, I need an enumeration. So lambda is a countable group. And so I need an enumeration of lambda, actually of lambda minus the identity. as lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3, etc. And this being chosen, I can define new n as follows. It's in the form of a convex combination. So I will put on new n a very large part of the weight, of the total weight, so 1 minus 1 over 2n. And then I will put a very small weight, 1 over 2n, on something else, but something else which is there just to make this measure quasi-lambda invariant, or lambda quasi-invariant, actually. And that's a sum over k of 1 over 2 to the k, lambda k, push forward of mu. And I really love that trick. The idea is just to average mu n. Mu n, we don't know anything. We don't know whether it's invariant, quasi-invariant. But we may push it around by the elements of lambda, but put them a very small weight. Take this convex combination. It's clear, I mean, the weights add up to 1, so it's a probability measure, which is very close to mu n, and which is, because mu n was very close to being lambda invariant, nu n is also very close to be lambda invariant, but the advantage is that nu n is quasi-invariant because, just by construction, because we put in the formula all the translates of mu n under the group elements. And that's it. And I think my time is over. It's related to distortion, as you may imagine.
If you have a group with a Hagel property,
yeah.
You say it is acting on a wall, on a measurable space.
Yeah.
But is there an explicit canonical description of the space associated to it?
I'm afraid I will refer you to the Chatterjee Grotto Hagel paper. There is a construction, yes, and it's reasonably explicit, but
yes.
it goes through several steps.
Because there's a difference between the real and the complex hyperbolic space.
Oh, yeah, yes. Yeah.
Oh. You can realize
the old question. Yeah.
The formula for the real case.
So
what's the wall structure for the complex?
So maybe I should have said that there is a book on the Hagel property by five authors. Felix, Colin, Jolissin, Jules, and myself. So, let's say, more or less, the content of the first talk can be found in that book. And indeed, we mentioned it as an open question, and I think it's still open. that if you replace real hyperbolic geometry by complex hyperbolic geometry, it's known that the distance function in complex hyperbolic geometry is negative definite, and therefore it should. This means that it really comes from the equivalent embedding of SU and 1 into some Hilbert space. And so this means that we know that for abstract reasons that this embedding exists, but we have no concrete model for it. So we have nothing like an embedding in L2 of the space of the hyperplanes or what.
There are concrete for the distance.
Yeah. So the point is that in real hyperbolic geometry, just because real hyperplanes do separate into two connecting components, we have the apparatus coming from spaces with walls. And so we may very concretely embed SU and 1 in L2 of the space of open half spaces. But the point is that if you try to mimic this in complex geometry, it fails right from the start, because hyperplanes do not disconnect in the complex world. And so, as a consequence, we have no model, no explicit model of explicit way to embed SU and 1 in a Hilbert space.
But it's in a Hilbert space, it's unique.
Pardon me?
It's unique just because the GLS construction is unique.
Yeah, if you want the Hilbert space to be generated by the image of the cocircle, then yes, then it's unique, yeah.
Because that's so. Anyway, yeah. That's very different because
something
on which it acts by the measure of structure is not unique, so that's more.
But what I have in mind is to relate this Hilbert space to standard notions from complex hyperbolic geometry, just like we do in real hyperbolic geometry. And this is not one. So at some point I tried to interest Bill Goldman into that, and he directed me to his spinor surfaces, so which are the media physics of two points in the complex. And indeed, these are real hypersurfaces which do separate, but that's apparently that's the only good property that they have.